I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Those of you who have been listening to the show as of late may recall that I recently was able to speak with the legendary playwright, novelist, essayist, and all-around maverick iconoclast, Ishmael Reed. I was very, very happy that I was able to have Ishmael on the program. And one thing that came up in the course of our conversation was an op-ed he wrote for the Washington Post on the CIA's potential connection to the LA crack epidemic by way of its involvement in the Iran-Contra affair. And he wrote that piece around the time that a journalist by the name of Gary Webb, who was working at the San Jose Mercury, caused a controversy with his now infamous Dark Alliance series. That series dealt with the aforementioned connection between the CIA's involvement in the Iran-Contra scandal and the LA crack epidemic. Webb faced intense scrutiny and criticism after the publication of Dark Alliance in what his defenders refer to as a case of killing the messenger rather than the message. A number of figures involved with major media outlets at that time pounced on Webb's reporting, taking aim at errors Webb made in the story. Jefferson Morley, however, stood in stark contrast to this trend. While he was working at the Washington Post, by helping to get some pieces published that looked at what Gary Webb got right, or at least where he was on the right track. After my conversation with Ishmael Reed, I decided to reach out to Jefferson Morley as someone familiar with his work, which includes such books as The Ghost, a biography of the CIA's James Angleton, and Our Man in Mexico, Winston Scott and the Hidden History of the CIA, in the hopes that he would be open to revisiting the case of Gary Webb and Dark Alliance. Now, what's interesting about this conversation is that we also delved into a number of other areas. You see, currently, Jefferson Morley runs the Deep State blog, where he has tirelessly reported on issues related to the cloak and dagger world of intelligence agencies and government secrecy. But as you will find out in this conversation, what Jefferson Morley means by deep state differs a great deal from that of, I don't know, maybe the Trump supporters, for example, that stormed the Capitol in their belief that Donald Trump was cheated out of a second presidential term by a so-called deep state conspiracy. Now, this conversation was recorded before that happened. Of course, I'm recording this on January 6th. Only a few hours ago, Trump supporters were storming the Capitol. Now, even though this conversation was recorded prior to that incident, I think that there's a lot here that is worth considering in light of what has just occurred. We delve into a number of different areas, including, again, revisiting the case of Gary Webb and Dark Alliance, as well as discussing the origins and meaning of the term deep state, the importance of news media, and the attacks on journalism and news media by Trump and his supporters, the issue of government secrecy, and the problems that arise from not holding intelligence agencies accountable all that and much more in this fascinating conversation. I think that it is very relevant, and I hope you enjoy it. So let's get right to it with former Washington Post reporter and editor Jefferson Morley of the Deep State blog. Welcome to Parallax Views. This guest has been a long time coming. Founder of the Deep State blog, author of Our Man in Mexico, Winston Scott and the Hidden History of the CIA, as well as The Ghost, a biography of James Angleton, and a former Washington Post reporter, Jefferson Morley. Welcome to Parallax Views.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jeff, I wanted to have you on the show because I recently interviewed Ishmael Reed, and he had mentioned you. He said that you helped get a work of his published in the Washington Post, a piece he wrote called The Ward on the Vine, in which he sort of defended Gary Webb a little bit. I don't know that we need to like dig into the details too much, but do you remember how that op-ed came to be?
I remember how it happened, and I was glad to do it. At the time, just by way of background for your readers, I'm a writer and journalist in Washington. I've been in Washington for a long time. I spent a big part of my career, not the most of it, but a big part, 15 years at the Washington Post as an editor and reporter, both at the newspaper and at WashingtonPost.com. So that's, you know, that was where I was when this happened. And in the 1990s, I had come to the job from reporting on politics and especially on Central America and civil wars in Central America for the New Republic and the Nation. And then that led me to the Washington Post. So I came with a lot of reporting experience. And in the 1990s, there was this big controversy created in part by the journalist Gary Webb and his series Dark Alliance about the CIA's relationship with drug traffickers and what did that contribute to America's drug problem at the time. And I thought that Gary Webb knew what he was talking about. And in fact, the CIA Inspector General issued a long report, which if you actually read it, confirmed a lot of what Gary Webb reported.
Was that the Hines report, I think, or?
The Hitz report, Frederick Hitz was the Inspector General of the CIA. And so the CIA did a very clever thing, which they do a lot. They wrote a two-page executive summary and they said, the Fred Hitz report completely exonerates the CIA from the charge that they were selling crack on the streets of America. Now, Gary Webb never said that, so that was a misleading statement in itself. And the report did not exonerate the CIA, but nobody read the whole report. Everybody read the two-page summary and they said, oh, look, Gary Webb is completely wrong and the CIA was right. If you go and you read Hitz's report, especially the second volume, starting about page 900, you will see that what Gary Webb is completely true, that the CIA did business with major drug trafficking organizations, seven of them, about 50 individuals who were all suspected of, you know, what we call high-level, multi-kiloton trafficking in cocaine, which, I mean, a lot of what Hitz reported, in fact, more than confirmed what Webb had said, went even farther. So at the time, we didn't know all of that, but I thought that Gary Webb was on to something. I had reported on the CIA and the Contras and the drug war a lot. And, you know, there were little problems with Webb's story, which were exploited by his critics unfairly. But the gist of what he was saying, a lot of it was true. So when this furor arose and people said, oh, look, the CIA didn't, you know, the CIA wasn't involved, I thought we had to have an alternative point of view. So I'd worked with Ishmael before on other pieces. He's a good writer, good thinker. And so I went to him and said, Ishmael, write this piece. So I looked at that as my job of bringing in, you know, a wider variety of points of view, especially if they were factually well-founded, which they were in this case. So that's how that story came to pass.
So I want to get more into the Gary Webb story and sort of the, I don't know, the fallout from that. You know, it caused a big controversy, and eventually, you know, Webb left this earth in a very, you know, very tragic manner. But first, I wanted to ask maybe more about your background in journalism. You seem to be a journalist that will question establishment narratives, but also doesn't, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, as some alternative media types kind of do, that, oh, you know, anything in the Washington Post or the New York Times is bad. So how'd you come to this sort of nuanced view?
Well, I was very fortunate in that I knew what I wanted to do in life when I was about 17. And I never, that was be a newspaper reporter and write about politics and political life and city life. Those were the things that I cared about, and I loved reporting and writing on them. And so I did that all my life. And, you know, I had a lot of luck, and I had a lot of success. And so I wound up at a place like the Washington Post. And, you know, the Washington Post is a very big institution. It's been around for a long time. And, you know, it has its flaws. It has its blind spots. But it's also a great news organization. And I would hope that in this time, especially after the past 4 years, we've seen what routine contempt for high quality journalism does to public life. You may not like the politics of the Washington Post. I didn't. But you know what? They cared about journalism. And if they said, oh, you know, Morley, you're all wet about, you know, Gary Webb and the CIA and Contras, and I came back with a good piece by a good writer like Ishmael Reed, I could get it run. So, you know, yes, there's a caricature view that you can see from outside. But, you know, I had a lot of problems with the Washington Post, and I also had a great time working there, you know, and that's human reality. You know, we work in flawed institutions, but, you know, it's like your family. You know, does it have problems? Does it have secrets? Yes, yes. You know, does that mean you repudiate it because it makes mistakes and does stupid things? No, it doesn't mean that at all. So it's important to keep those high standards of, you know, facts matter. Is there such a thing as objectivity? You know, does the mainstream media overdo on the one hand, on the other hand, ism? Yeah, probably. Do they care about getting it right? Yes, definitely. You know, do the people who bitch and moan about the Washington Post, could they do what the people at the Washington Post do? You know, some of them could, and some of them would help the Washington Post do a better job. But a lot of them, you know, couldn't actually do it, you know? So there's a high standard there. And as a professional, you know, you strive to meet it. So that's where I come from in doing all of this, is we have to keep the lens of high quality journalism open as wide as possible. And I always saw that as my mission, you know, at the Post or outside the Post.
I was going to say, I think a lot of the problem with how people critique the media comes down to, you know, there's people that'll say, oh, the Washington Post, that's just mainstream. And they'll complain, or they'll do this with the New York Times, they'll complain about certain writers at these outfits, but they're never actually complaining about the reporters. They're usually complaining about the opinion editorialists. And there's very little distinction made between, you know, the hard-hitting reporting and the editorialists.
Yeah, yeah. No, and this is a problem that the internet encourages, because everything on your screen looks the same. And so it is harder to differentiate content. And so, yeah, you know, people say, oh God, you know, they're so mainstream, they run Bret Stephens. You know, if you're the proprietor of a major newspaper at this time, you know, it's your job to hire a conservative columnist. You know, people who don't understand that are babies. They're politically immature. You know, if you work at a major news organization, you want a wide variety of opinions. And you know what? You want opinions that are going to offend your friends. I'm sorry. You're going to, if on my publication, you know, you're going to read something that you don't agree with. You might be offended. Good. That's the way it's supposed to be. You know, that's what you need from a publication, is you need a publication that will challenge you on occasion. So that's the mission I bring to it, is you're not getting a free ride. You're not promised a comfort zone. This is not a safe zone. This is not a safe place necessarily. You know, It's a newspaper. You're going to read bad news. You're going to read stuff that upsets you. You know, that's life.
And what do you think, if there is a criticism to be made of, you know, what's called the mainstream media or corporate media, what do you think the biggest criticism is? Do you think there's something to be said for the sort of Noam Chomsky criticism of media?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a paper like the Washington Post is implicated in the power structure of Washington. It has to position itself. It takes positions in regard to other power factions. And there's times when the paper has not shown a lot of editorial bravery because of that. You know, I'm thinking of the run-up to the Iraq War. Now, if you read the Washington Post reporting in that period, there were four or five excellent pieces that debunked claims of the Bush administration. It wasn't that the reporters didn't do a good job. It was that the editors didn't put it on page one. Okay. And so that's where the nerve was lacking. It wasn't lacking in the reporters. Walter Pincus, Joby Warrick, Dana Priest. These reporters did excellent work. The editorial page was unfortunately in favor of the war and never really explained itself. But the reporters did a good job. The editors who put it all together, they could have been more aggressive. And I think they would have looked a lot better in retrospect if they had put some of those stories on page one. So is the critique valid? Sure it is. Has Noam Chomsky ever covered, you know, the cops in metropolitan DC? Has he ever covered the real estate? Has he ever covered the immigrant community? You know, running a daily newspaper of record is a huge enterprise. It's not all, are you right about the Iraq war? You know, it's how do you cover a big urban area in a responsible way, in a responsible, effective way? So it's very easy to be an armchair critic of the mainstream media. It's very hard. That's not to say that they don't have very good points. I just say, I've been inside. It's tough to put out a newspaper 7 days a week. It's a big enterprise and you're going to make a lot of mistakes. You got to be humble when you're doing it, you know? So is the mainstream media arrogant? Definitely. What's the alternative? To not have elite media? To not have newspapers that strive for fairness? To not have newspapers that incorporate points of view that you don't like? That's not a good alternative.
Yeah, I think that the problem that comes up is a lot of people take their, you know, critique of media and they go from, you know, that sort of level-headed structural call for reform that you see in Chomsky's work. And sometimes, you know, people will move away from that into the realm of just what Trump has done, you know, where he's basically saying the Lugan pressa. And, you know, that's very dangerous when we're attacking journalists, when you have presidents attacking journalists and people backing this up because they say, oh, well, the lying press. And you can't have that in a functioning democracy.
You can't. And so, you know, I would hope that people on my side, the left, would understand a little bit the danger and appreciate the importance of journalism. And yes, on the one hand, on the other hand, journalism. You know, a key thing is for me, is to write in a way that somebody who doesn't agree with me politically can still get the point. Okay? So you don't have to agree with me. And I was on last night with a podcaster, a very young, gung-ho kind of, you know, military, you know, gung-ho Marine type, you know, and he really liked my book on Angleton. And I was saying to him, I have a lot of criticism of James Angleton. You know, I think a lot of things he did were really bad, you know, and from a liberal, left liberal point of view, I say them, but I wanted to write the book in a way that people who liked him, and there were lots of people who liked him, you know, could also come away and learn something. And so, you know, you've got to think about how the other guy's going to see it, you know? And it's not all about, am I right? Am I right? Am I right? And this is what the internet and especially social media is, where the influence has been very pernicious. And I would say even on the left, it encourages this, you know, let's boil it down to 280 words and, you know, own the other guy, you know, and I got an opinion about everything. Well, you know, I don't have an opinion about everything. And if I gave it to you, it'd probably be wrong. You know, it's like, to me, all that stuff feels incredibly arrogant. I try and work on the factual record and present it in a way that people can understand it. you know, is the mainstream media reflect corporate interests? Of course it does, you know, but, you know, and people say, oh, well, you know, Jeff Bezos has a contract with the CIA. Yeah, that's true. That's definitely true. You know, that's a potential conflict of interest. People should watch that very carefully. Is Jeff Bezos, you know, a good custodian of a newspaper of record? Definitely, he is. I mean, there's no sign of political influence brought to bear on that. The editorial page is still, to my mind, very stodgy and conservative. Bezos hasn't interfered with that, you know. Maybe he should. But, you know, we've been through a period where we've had a very keen understanding of what the contempt for journalism does, okay? So people who have contempt for journalism, I think, should think very carefully about it right now. That's, I'm asking you, whoever is out there, you know, that's my plea. You know, that's those are the constraints that we work under. Those are the times we live in. We should appreciate it.
Yeah, I think sometimes, you know, I think it's fair to criticize maybe a Jeff Bezos and what influence he may exert on the Post. Maybe we should talk about that. But at the same time, I don't think that people should kill the messenger. You know, I just had Catherine Stewart on, who has done really great work on the Christian right and evangelicals and their sort of influence in politics. And she writes at the Washington Post. And, you know, to just throw journalists under the bus when you reference corporate media, it's not that simple. So I'm curious in that regard, how did you sort of get into this area of journalism where you're discussing things that a lot of people see as sort of, I don't want to say conspiratorial, but people will look and see JFK, CIA, intelligence agencies, and the deep state and say, oh, is this like conspiracy stuff? How would you respond to that?
You know, just read the content. You'll see right away that it's not conspiracy. It's all factually founded, solid sources, which I describe. So, you know, I mean, if people think that, you know, that's unfortunate. But I think, you know, I think the product speaks for itself. And you know what? People are very interested in this subject. The secret sector of the U.S. government is enormous, right? The U.S. intelligence community is 17 different agencies. If you take those 17 agencies and add up their annual budgets, it's probably about $75 billion a year. And most of what those agencies do is off the record, sort of off limits to you and me, and maybe even off limits to our congressional representatives. So that's a serious line of business right there, period. And people should pay attention to it. So in my work, I try and illuminate that world, and also in a way that kind of sidesteps these, like, you know, are you a conspiracy theorist? You know, no, I'm a journalist. So I write about facts. I write about theory. You know, I don't write about theories. I mean, maybe you write about theories sort of on the side, but the job is putting new facts on the record and putting old facts in perspective. And so that's what I try to do. And, you know, the fact that these subjects are controversial, I mean, to me, that's, I gravitate to that because that's where the readers are, right? People want to know, like, what should I believe? Is this true? How could this possibly be true? Oh, that's ridiculous. Well, okay, here's a source of information and, you know, figure it out. And so I don't try and impose my views on people. If you read my stuff, you know where I'm coming from, but I don't try and impose it on people. I try and show them things they didn't know before. And, you know, I think people like that. You know, my blog, Deep States, which is devoted to monitoring the world's intelligence agencies and aggregates quality reporting on intelligence agencies from around the world. You know, I mean, we've gone from 300 viewers a day to, you know, 6,000 a day in less than a year. And that's because people want to know this stuff. You know, they want to know and they want a reliable source of information. They don't want some BS and people come say, well, it must be true because I read it on the internet. You know, like, that's not good enough anymore, or it shouldn't be. We've seen the effect of that. You know, I read it on the internet, so it must be true. You know, we got to do better than that as a country and as a citizenry. So my journalism is designed to help people do that.
I was going to say in that regard, sometimes I feel like the term conspiracy theory is actually thrown around too much. You know, I was just talking to someone about, you know, now the right is sort of trying to weaponize claims of electoral fraud and saying, oh, yeah, the voting machines are rigged. And, you know, there were left-leaning journalists that were worried about electronic voting in the 2000 and 2004 election. Now, I'm not saying I agree with everything that was said about companies like Diebold, but I do think interesting things came out of the journalism of people like Bob Fitrakis, who was pointing out that, you know, Diebold had connections to very well-heeled Christian evangelicals. And I think that's worth knowing about, regardless of whether we trust electronic voting machines or not. I think it's good to ask questions, even if you don't make a conspiracy out of it.
Yeah, no question about it. That, you know, and we've seen the importance of really understanding the mechanics of our electoral system and how important that is. So we do need to bring to bear on that. But, you know, we also do have this tradition of, you know, free and fair elections. And, you know, our system, believe it or not, you know, vindicated itself. You know, a majority of the people spoke and there was a peaceful transition of power. So, you know, I think people should appreciate our institutions. You know, they should have it more appreciated because the people who have contempt for them, we see what they do and what they want to do, you know, and they want to destroy democratic institutions. So I want to criticize them and I want to hold people accountable, but I don't want to contribute to the destruction of democratic norms or traditions, you know, and that's the job of journalism now, is to be critical without undermining the basic system that we're all depending on if we want to live in a free country.
Now, getting back to your reporting, when did you first start getting into the subjects like intelligence agencies or things like, you know, the stories?
When I started in journalism in Washington in the early 80s, the hot story, the big story was the civil wars in Central America. And would the United States support first a military dictatorship in El Salvador, which was under facing a popular rebellion from the left and from the poor majority, and then Nicaragua, where a leftist government was defending itself from a right-wing counter-revolution, which was sponsored by the CIA and the Reagan White House. And so this was the issue. You know, this was. In 1985, there was a story on, I think it was 1985, there was a story on the front page of the New York Times about El Salvador, I think 165, 170 times. In other words, you know, once every 3 days, more than that, there was a front page story on El Salvador, you know, a small country that nobody had ever really heard of in a couple of years before. So that was just the story. Everybody was covering about it. Everybody was writing about it. It was a big deal in Congress. You know, it was the ideological polarizing issue. I worked at the New Republic at the time. So it was this very hot issue. And so I dove right in, you know, talking, meeting as many people as I could. And as you got into the story, you realized you could not write about this stuff and not talk about the role of the CIA. Now, nobody wanted to talk about it, but you knew it was happening. And if you knew who to talk to, you could get some insight into what was going on. So I had a friend who said, Jeff, what you want to do is you want to go talk to some former CIA people who don't work there anymore and will feel more free to talk. And better yet, if you have a document to show them, like that mentions, you know, their name or a country that they worked in, or, you know, then they're even more likely to talk to you. And so that's how I got into it. I started talking to experts on Central America, experts on guerrilla warfare, experts on the Latin American left, experts on the Latin American right, the Bush administration. And so I started writing. So my first covers, I wrote a cover story for the New Republic in 1985 about the Contras and the CIA. And so that was really when I really got going, and I never lost my interest in it. That over time led me to, then we had the Iran-Contra scandal, which I had, as an editor, had run one of the first articles. Even before it broke, we broke a piece of the story in the New Republic. So that was always interested in that. And then those civil wars ended in the 90s. The Soviet Union went away. But I remained interested in the CIA, and then got more interested, especially in the history. And in the history of the CIA, I discovered, you know, you could go back and 30 years later, a lot of the stories had been declassified or people would talk about them, you know? And so my interest continued, it deepened, and I started writing about not just contemporary events involving the CIA, but also historical events. And that led to my books.
Now, in regards to those books, and the blog itself that you run, The Deep State, what do you make of this idea of the deep state? Because I think it's been sort of hijacked by, you know, the Trumpist right. And I don't think that people like Peter Dale Scott, who have used the term, are using it in quite the same way.
No. People use it in very different ways. I mean, I wouldn't say hijacked. I would say, you know, political terminology undergoes these bends as ideas spread and are reshaped and all that. So, you know, the idea of deep politics, which was first articulated by Peter Scott, an academic at the University of California, but also a former diplomat, so a man with international experience. His idea was that American politics was affected and shaped by events that were took place at a deeper level, not visible to the public often, involving intelligence agencies, organized crime, offshore capital. And he used this to explain events from the Kennedy assassination to Watergate to the international drug trade. In 2014, a guy used the phrase the deep state. Mike Lofgren was kind of a libertarian Republican. And he used the deep state to describe a kind of state of inertia in Washington where entrenched interests, including the intelligence community, but also corporate interests, were able to control the political system and effectively deadlock it so that they could always protect their interests. When Steve Bannon noticed that this article and this phrase drove a lot of traffic, he started using it on Breitbart, using it to refer to the intelligence community in general, and exploited it. And Trump used it to describe, you know, he used the deep state to describe, you know, basically anybody who criticized him. You know, it didn't have any intellectual or not much intellectual coherence. I mean, these people were, you know, from elite institutions. They tended to hold, you know, militaristic multinational views, you know, multilateral perspective on global politics. But, you know, their politics were by no means uniform. You know, Michael Hayden was a CIA director, you know, who was fired by President Obama. You know, John Brennan was a CIA director who was hired by Obama. So Trump's approach was opportunistic and scattershot. But I think that politically it worked for him because he is describing a real phenomenon. There is this huge sector of the US government that is secret. It has operated beyond, you know, public view, and it has made catastrophically, colossally stupid mistakes like the invasion of Iraq. And so President Trump was able to exploit that. And the problem that we have with these agencies is because they are so immune, have been so immune to criticism, you know, they still don't think that they have to change. And this is the problem with the Biden administration. You know, Joe Biden got elected because he just said, we're going to calm down. We're going to do things the normal way. You know, we're just going to go back and, you know, a solid majority of the American people said, good idea. Let's do that, Joe. That we're with you. You know, they didn't want anything adventurous. They didn't want Bernie. They didn't want Elizabeth Warren. They wanted this guy who they've seen for a long time. No surprises. You know exactly what you're getting right down the middle of the road. And, you know, more power to him. You know, he solved a big problem that we had as a country, at least temporarily. But, you know, the people around him tend to think, you know, Iraq wasn't a disaster. Afghanistan wasn't a disaster. And so they're a little complacent, you know, and Trump exploited that complacency, that arrogant complacency. And so Trump, we don't have to worry about in the same way anymore. But, you know, that arrogant complacency is still there, too. So that's a risk we have going forward, you know, is that this crowd around Biden hasn't really learned anything from the Trump experience. I hope they have. I think they have. But it's not a sure thing by any means.
I was going to say, too, it's interesting to me because I've always questioned Trump supporters when they talk about the deep state. And yet, you know, there's Trump supporters like Michael Schur out there. And I mean, to me, Michael Schur is very connected to the intelligence community. And I think you've done some really important articles. I was reading one a few months ago where you talked about Micah Schuer and his sort of connections to the CIA in the pre-9/11 era. So I think
that's why I say it's incoherent. I mean, Trump gave the CIA 90% of what they wanted. Trump didn't like the fact that former CIA directors were going on TV and saying, you're a liar. You know, he didn't really object to what the CIA was doing. In fact, he took restrictions off on CIA drone strikes. He took restrictions off rules of engagement in Syria. He did exactly what the CIA wanted in targeting General Soleimani from Iran. You know, Trump was perfectly happy with the so-called deep state that he abhorred. And let me tell you, the story that's really telling about Trump and the so-called deep state and the fact that he's really not serious about challenging the institutional power of these institutions. He just wants to make them obedient to him. He doesn't care about, you know, actually reforming them. He just wants to, he wanted them to obey him. And quite rightly, they rejected that idea. And we're glad that they did. But, you know, in October 2017, the last of the JFK assassination files were supposed to be made public, all of them. It was a 25-year deadline for disclosure that was set in 1992 by a unanimous act of Congress. And so after 25 years in 2017, all the files were supposed to be made public. CIA Director Mike Pompeo and FBI Director Christopher Wray went to Trump, had a meeting with him, and they said, you can't release all of these records. You have to let us keep certain things secret. And so Trump did what he usually did. He went on Twitter and he said, all of the JFK files have been released. This is October 2017, ahead of time, okay? Neither part of that was true. All of the JFK records had not been released. The next day, Trump signed a memo giving the CIA and the FBI and other federal agencies 4 more years to continue withholding their JFK, any JFK file that they wanted from public view. And this wasn't, you know, they said, oh, you know, we need to take out the names of agents and stuff like that. That's not what they did. They withheld 15,834 different documents. Sometimes just a word, other times it's a 20-page document from secrecy. So Trump, the guy who was, you know, had his own JFK conspiracy theory and promised to release all of these records, he just broke his promise. He caved because it was, in the end, it was more convenient for him to do the CIA's bidding than to actually challenge them on something that they really wanted, which was JFK secrecy. So Trump wasn't really serious there. And my friends who like Trump, that's one thing that they were all disappointed in, that he did not do that. And then they came up with some other conspiracy theory about, oh, well, you know, they wouldn't let him do that or anything. You know, the fact is he chickened out. He just didn't want to do it because he would have paid a price. And he didn't really care about the principle. With Trump, it's always, you know, what's in it for him? And there was nothing in it for him. And so we got 4 more years of JFK secrecy.
Yeah, I was going to say, in regards to JFK, I have listeners that believe that Oswald was a lone assassin. I have listeners that don't. There's arguments about it all the time. But for me, the real question is that question of JFK secrecy. Why can't we have the documents? And some people will say, well, national security, and we need some secrecy, which I think there's an argument that can be made for that. But having too much secrecy and not enough transparency really has an effect that's negative on our democracy. Could you comment on that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's insane. It is crazy that the CIA is there withholding thousands of JFK documents. I mean, they've got to know what that does for their credibility. They're under suspicion because of many examples of malfeasance in the events before and after the assassination, evidence destroyed, misleading statements, cover-ups, all of that is definitely true. And so why 50 plus years later would you still be hiding things if you cared about your credibility? You know, and the only conclusion I draw is the stuff that's in there, they don't want out. They're scared of it. It's embarrassing. And I think knowing a little bit about what they are withholding, they're right. You know, they're hiding something highly embarrassing to themselves. So I'm not spinning any theory about it. It's not my job to come up with a theory. It's their job to release the records. So, and they didn't do it, you know, and Trump didn't do it. So we have that challenge of these secret agencies are arrogant. They think they don't have to obey the law, or they can twist the law, which they did in the case of the JFK records, you know, twist the law to somehow justify, use an open government law to continue secrecy. You know, they're very clever in that way, you know, and it's just like, that's why people, you know, are suspicious or, you know, or worse about the CIA. Their behavior encourages it.
I was going to say, beyond just the JFK case, why do you think it's so important that we have a balance between transparency and secrecy? Does anything come to mind specifically that makes a strong case for why we need more transparency from these agencies?
One is just what we were talking about before, right? I mean, the way to have trust in government is to have the maximum amount of transparency. We have a huge, staggeringly large amount of government records that are secret for no reason. And these JFK records are just one example. So, you know, it interferes with the ability of the people in the Congress to oversee the government and, you know, make it obey the will of the people. If government agencies can operate in secret, you know, they are by definition beyond the reach of the public, of the Congress. So, you know, that's not good. And, you know, what are the dangers, right? I mean, there's another, right? You have transparency, civil liberties on the one hand, and you have secrecy and safety on the other. You know, what are the dangers? What are the dangers right now? I mean, you know, we don't have existential dangers, you know, that justify this level of secrecy. We do have existential dangers like climate change and, you know, migration, uncontrolled migration and diseases, right? But you can't, these aren't national problems, you know? And so the idea of a clandestine service to take on a pandemic, if it helps you prepare and understand and, you know, get ready, that's fine. But in terms of like, you know, cloak and dagger and undermining the enemy, it's really passe. And so, you know, intelligence agencies have a new challenge now, and U.S. intelligence agencies especially, you know, we're in a new paradigm of, you know, what makes us safe, right? We spend $600 billion a year on defense, you know, and how much has that defended us in the past year from a very dangerous threat, continuing threat? Not really much at all, you know? And in fact, it diverted a lot of resources that might have been used to prepare more effectively for this. Well, if people in the national security complex are paying attention, they should understand, and I think they will understand, you know, whether it's sooner rather than later is the question, but I think they will understand that we need a new approach to national security, because, you know, this idea that we were very well prepared over the last 20 years. We got ourselves very, very well prepared to take on the threat of, you know, transnational groups of Islamic jihadists, you know, who Al-Qaeda, ISIS, those types of things. We prepared very, very well for that. And it's not really the threat that, you know, hit us with a devastating blow. Not at all. We were over-prepared for one thing and under-prepared for another. So hopefully we'll get it right.
I was going to say, in that regard, it's really interesting to me that you bring this up, because I was talking to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who served as chief of staff under Colin Powell, and he was telling me about how Obama once told him that there is a pro-war bias in D.C. And of course, Obama's national security advisor, Ben Rhodes, complained about the D.C. blob or the foreign policy consensus. Do you think there's this problem in D.C. of an old guard that thinks in terms of the Cold War and can't get out of that paradigm, and that maybe a new guard needs to arise?
Yeah, I mean, originally, you know, after World War II, you know, for the next 50 years, 40 plus years, we were in a Cold War, a militarized confrontation with another nuclear armed superpower. Soviet Union collapsed. We had about 10 years of, you know, change. And then we had 9/11. And since 9/11, we've had a new paradigm, the war on terror, you know, and just as the Cold War paradigm exhausted itself and then disappeared, you know, the war on terror paradigm is passing, right? Even the people who, you know, like who used to complain the most about, you know, terrorism, you don't hear that much anymore. The transnational jihadists have focused their efforts on Syria, on Iraq. They haven't been attacking Western targets as much. They're not the existential threat. You know, I don't think they ever were, but you know, that paradigm is going away. It's no longer relevant. That's not, nobody feels that that's the threat that we face. So, you know, yeah, we do need a new order. I mean, Biden does not represent that, and the people around him do not represent that. The question is, you know, are they open to change? Can they change in the future? And you know, these are smart people. They're competent people. Thank God, you know, we have people who, whether you like their politics or not, you know, they're serious about their jobs. They're not clowns. They're not out to score points. They're not making crap up. You know, they might make mistakes and they might do dumb things, but they're actually acting normally. And that's a great relief. At least we can begin to think about how we might recover.
Now, before we close out this conversation, I wanted to go back to Gary Webb because it's interesting when it comes to Dark Alliance, and there's a new series out that you've also covered called The Last Narc, which is getting some exposure and causing Dark Alliance to be brought up again in some media outlets. What's interesting to me is that even when I talk to supporters of Dark Alliance, and I do consider myself a supporter of Gary Webb's work, people will say that, oh yeah, that's Dark Alliance. That's the book in the series about, you know, the CIA trafficking drugs. And I say, no, I don't think he ever said that they were directly trafficking drugs. So what is the actual claim that Gary Webb made for people that may be getting that confused?
What the CIA was doing when they were sponsoring counter-revolutionaries in Central America in 1970 and in the 1980s, and they were facing congressional opposition and, in fact, laws which said you cannot aid these people. So so the Reagan White House, in a large-scale, there's no other word for it, conspiracy, criminal conspiracy, about five top officials were indicted, three top CIA officials were indicted on conspiracy charges, to bypass the Congress and defraud the people and implement their own policy over the will of Congress. And so to do that, they hired independent contractors. And what they wanted to do was ship guns to the counter-revolutionary forces in Central America in an undisclosed way. Well, if you're in the covert operations business, what do you want? You want to transport contraband, illicit material, secretly, okay? Well, if that's your business, and you need to hire people, you go to companies, you know, drug traffickers, that's what they do. They move contraband secretly. So when the CIA wanted to do that, they went and found these guys. And what the traffickers would do is they'd make their planes available to the Ollie North and the Reagan administration. They would fly the guns down there, give them to the Contras, to the counter-revolutionary forces. Then you have an empty plane. What do? Your friends come after all the guns have been distributed and the Americans have gone away, and your friends come in, load the plane up with drugs, and you fly back to the United States, and you know that it's safe because you work for the government. And that's like why the biggest trafficker in Honduras, the guy, one of the guys at the heart of The Last Narc, Ramon Ballestero Mata, that's what he did. And he got a contract with Ollie North and he was shipping guns. So did the CIA sell drugs? No. They did business with Ramon Ballestero Matos, who, you know, sold multi-hundred kiloton packages of cocaine to distributors in the United States. So the CIA enabled the drug traffic.
By looking the other way.
Right. The CIA didn't you know, sell the drugs. And the CIA may not have even known what Ballestero Matos was doing. I mean, that's because they didn't want to know. And they didn't tell the DEA that they were in league with a major league trafficker. And they knew that they were in league with a major league trafficker. So the CIA didn't sell the drugs. They enabled the selling of the drugs. And this is where Gary Webb was absolutely right. these traffickers were at the very top of the trade, right? A lot of people smuggle drugs, right? People put drugs in their suitcase and come to the United States. You know, some people go to FedEx and put it in a package and they send a big box to the United States. Okay. These guys were bringing in drugs by the tractor trailer truck full. You know, they were bringing in multi-hundred kiloton loads of cocaine. Well, when those packages of cocaine hit Los Angeles, and this is what Gary Webb did very well, was the first to do, was he began to work his way through the drug supply chain. And so he went from the Contras who were working for the CIA to the guy who was getting not all of that cocaine, but a big shipment of it. And that was Freeway Ricky Ross in LA. And so Freeway Rick, he'd hit the jackpot. He had huge amounts of cocaine. So he would dilute it into crack, right? So you could step it on it and increase its volume by, you know, 80, 90%, okay? Those shipments of cocaine brought in by the CIA-enabled, CIA-protected traffickers put huge amounts of crack cocaine on the cocaine on the streets of America, where then it was turned into crack, highly addictive, and it spread like wildfire among poor people, you know, first among Black poor people and then among white poor people. And that was, you know, everybody was so upset about, you know, crack cocaine. But if you follow the supply chain like Gary Webb did, you realized at the top were these protected class of traffickers. And people say, oh, well, you know, it didn't make a difference, you know, but the importation of cocaine in those quantities definitely contributed to the drug problem that appeared on America's streets. If those CIA traffickers had not brought in 200 kilos of cocaine, you know, there wouldn't have been that many crack addicts in LA, you know, but it's a distant chain. No, the CIA didn't sell drugs. They just looked the other way, you know, and which is pretty bad if you think about it, right? I mean, and I urge people to go online, go to the CIA website and read Fred Hitz's report, especially the second volume. And you will see everything that Gary Webb said was true in spades. He was definitely on the right track about this phenomenon of CIA-enabled cocaine shipments.
So in regards to where Webb could be criticized, is it mainly in maybe getting little details wrong and overshooting on the thesis that it was the CIA that caused the crack epidemic?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's an art to writing a newspaper story. There's an art to writing a long newspaper story. And so, you know, at the top, you have what we call the lead or the nut graph, right? You want to catch people's interest. And then you want to say, here's why you should keep reading, right? Because you're going to lay out a lot of stuff. And Gary Webb, you know, you're going to lay out a complicated story. So you have to kind of summarize it simply at the top. And there, I think, you know, he made some statements that people could jump on and say, you're saying the CIA sold drugs, you know, and he wasn't saying that. But it's a tough thing. It's a subtle thought to get right. And so, you know, I mean, as an editor, I wished I'd had first crack at it because I think I could have solved it. You know, I could have, what we say is, you know, made it bulletproof. I could have anticipated kinds of attacks that he would get. And, you know, and in a good editorial process, these attacks aren't ideological. It's like, does that really make sense? Are you sure? Are you saying it right? Have you summarized it right? You know, there's a big argument about how to get things right, especially in a complicated story. And it's a very collegial environment. And, you know, Gary Webb, you know, there were some things that were problems. And then, you know, his problem was his editors just chickened out. They wouldn't defend the words that they edited. And then they said, oh, well, you know, he got it wrong, you know? And it was like, they chickened out. They should have taken responsibility and said, we stand by this story because the facts were pretty strong. You know, I mean, there's a lot of problems in reporting about drug trafficking, you know, government informants, you know, lawbreakers, you know, it's tough. It's tough to get things right. You know, it's a lot of BS in that world, both on the government side and on the side of the criminals, you know, so. But I think he did a pretty good job. And, you know, it was certainly defensible. And it's too bad the paper chickened out because they had a good story and they could have defended it.
Now, you're at the Post during this time. What was it like in the Washington Post newsrooms? Were there reactions to Gary Webb and the Dark Alliance series? What was going on there? I know you've written about Ben Bradley.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it was a big story. It was a big news story. We had to cover it. John Deutsch, CIA director, went and did a town hall in South Central LA. You know, so it was a big news story. I mean, the instinctive reaction was, Gary Webb's a nut. This is stupid. We got to shoot it down. And that's what the first day coverage reflected. I mean, then there was
why
a second
was that the
day.
Reaction?
Why? Because people, you know, believe the government. You know, Washington Post, a liberal newspaper, trust in government. CIA says it's BS. Well, you know, this one reporter from an, you know, not from one of our major competitors. You know, we believe the CIA. It was too bad. And I disagreed with it. We had a second day story that was better. And then I came back in the opinion section with Ishmael's piece. So, you know, there was room for discussion. Overall, I think the paper's performance was pretty bad, especially in hindsight. So, a liberal newspaper in the Capitol is going to be deferential towards government agencies. So the CIA benefits from that. It's not a conspiracy. It's a cultural outlook.
No, I see what you mean there, because I think there's a lot of criticism now of things like access journalism. And, you know, I'm not saying that I think there's pros and cons to that kind of journalism, but it can become an issue where you show deference to an agency or certain people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that I think that the Post learned something from the experience with the Bush administration, and they definitely learned something from the experience with Trump. It doesn't pay to show deference. It just doesn't. I mean, controversy, you know, that can be tough to take. You don't want to be politicized, you know, because then you start losing the trust of the readers who don't share your politics. But that's, you know, it's a constant challenge, you know. And so, yeah, you know, access journalism, especially if you're writing about the CIA and you're writing about it on a daily basis. I mean, how do you find out what the CIA is doing in real time? You're going to have access to senior officials. Now, are senior officials going to spin you? Absolutely. Is it possible to do that job and stay independent of those sources? Absolutely. And look at a guy like Tim Weiner at the New York Times. You know, he had a lot of access, but he was an independent reporter. CIA couldn't take him for granted, didn't like his coverage a lot of times. So, you know, if you're writing for a broad audience of composed of, you know, expert people, and you're covering the CIA in real time, you're going to have to try and get access. And that's going to have its cost. That's called journalism. You know, you got to figure out how to do that. Are there lazy reporters who rely too much on inside sources? Yeah, absolutely. Are there lazy bloggers who criticize intelligence reporters for having inside sources? Yeah, they've never had to cover the CIA. So it's easy to sit in your armchair, read about the CIA in the New York Times, and then say, oh, look, the mainstream media doesn't cover the CIA. You know, that's very easy to do. It's just, it doesn't tell you much, you know, it's a posture. Yes, it's perfectly legitimate to criticize these organizations for failures in their coverage. But the high-handed, you know, superior tone that people take, you know, I used to see this all the time at Washington Post. I mean, how come the Washington Post, you know, doesn't cover this? You know, it's like, buddy, here's the story. We covered that like 3 weeks ago. You know, it's like that happens all the time. And so, you know, I myself, that's why I'm not a media critic. I kind of stay out of it, you know, like it's very self-aggrandizing, I think, to sit around and say, you know, oh, bad mainstream media, get out there and do some reporting, you know, don't play that game, you know, it's much more important to do the real reporting.
It's interesting because I think that's a note that we can start to wrap up on, because I think the key criticism you can make when it comes to the response to Gary Webb's Dark Alliance is, okay, if there's problems with what Gary Webb said, if there were factual errors, if he overstated shot on the thesis, don't kill the messenger, but investigate the strongest claims.
No, and that's what we said. And that, and then if you look back at the at the post coverage, there was a very bad first day story, and then a bunch of us objected, and there was a decent second day story saying, yeah, there actually was a lot of, there is a lot of evidence to support what Webb was saying, and here it is, you know. So it, you know, yeah, it can be done, and you know, it was necessary in that case. So you know, and the Washington Post, you know, I mean, I think they blew it on the first day story, but they got it on the second, you know, they were open to a second day story. They were open to Ishmael Reed's story. So, you know, that's what a newspaper of record does, is it constantly corrects itself.
Now, in closing, is there anything else you wanted to say about Gary Webb or maybe this news series? I know you wrote an article on it, The Last Snark. What do you think the importance of these stories are in the present day?
Well, I mean, I thought the last NARC was interesting because, I mean, there's a lot of debate about that. And, you know, that's the product of a DEA agent, and some of his colleagues, you know, disagree with him about that. But, you know, what it tells me is, in retrospect, you know, if we look back on these things and, you know, what do our tastemakers in Hollywood and Netflix, you know, what do they think is credible, and what do they think the audience wants to hear? And, you know, The Last Snark reflects a hunger for a little more critical perspective on the way the drug war unfolded and the, you know, the unseemly alliances between, you know, the CIA and drug traffickers. And so, you know, I thought, you might disagree with the show, but you know, there's a new openness to understanding what was really going on there. And we're seeing this, you know, more generally with a rethinking of, you know, the criminalized punitive prohibition approach to drug policy. You know, it also bred corruption between major traffickers and the CIA. That's, you know, another thing the drug war did. And we're starting to see that now. So I think Gary Webb was a hero. And I always recommend when I teach this subject, I recommend that excellent movie about him, you know, and hope that everybody has learned something from it.
As a final thought, I noticed that you wrote an alternate piece on Steven Spielberg's The Post, and I thought you had some interesting ideas in there when you look at the Post today and The Post as it's covered in Spielberg's movie. What do you make of this current moment and where The Post is at in comparison to that time period?
Well, you know, I mean, the movies is a piece of hagiography, and I think I mentioned that story. I talked one time with Ben Bradley about that period at The Post, and you know, he was kind of highly embarrassed by it. He felt like the New York Times had scooped the hell out of The Post, and The Post, you know,
yeah, he was like yelling about, "Oh God, we're stuck in their tailpipes."
Yeah, no, and when I talked to him, which was not in the context of the movie, it was long before that, and I just said, you know, he did not remember it as a moment of glory the way it is presented in the movie. So I thought that was amusing. You know, I mean, the paper at that time had to figure out, you know, were they going to buy this argument, the government's argument that, you know, this was a threat to national security? And, you know, to their credit, they decided no, you know, that they weren't going to go along with it. You know, I mean, that the fact that the New York Times had gone first made it infinitely easier for them in a political sense. But it was not without risk because, as the movie said, you know, the Washington Post did own TV stations, and those could be challenged, or you could lose your license because of the federal government. So it took a lot of courage. You know, I mean, we want our journalists to be heroes. And as a journalist, you know, a good journalistic myth, I think that's fine. You know, I like the profession to be kind of glamorized, you know, and people realize the value of it. So, you know, when you have a pro journalism movie, even if it's like a little hagiographic, you know, I like that. You know, I have a higher tolerance for that because, hey, that's the hometown team for me. You know, but, you know, a movie like Spotlight, about the Boston Globe under Marty Baron, who is now the editor of the Washington Post and who is a great editor, you know, no question about it. if you look at the post performance in the last year, in the past 4 years, it's been pretty good. I think now the post is in a good place.
Do you think there's a parallel between that time period, the days of Daniel Ellsberg, and now? Because, you know, it seems like Nixon may have lit a fire under the butt of the press, and maybe Trump did that too in a way.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think there are differences between big differences between Nixon and Trump. I mean, Nixon was a very canny and competent president, even if you didn't like his policies. He knew what he was doing, and he had he thought a long ways ahead, and he had an idea of what he wanted to do. He was a dictatorial, corrupt and conniving guy, but he was extremely smart. Trump is extremely corrupt, but he's not extremely smart. So that's a bit, that's a big difference. But in terms of lighting a fire under the press and making people realize that, Ben Bradley was, totally in bed with the CIA 10 years before in the 1960s, right? He didn't question anything they said. 10 years later, he didn't have any choice but to be much more skeptical of them. He had learned a lot himself, and his newsroom had learned way more than that. So he had to change, and a good newspaper, you change with the times, you understand we're in a new political reality and you adjust to it. And so I think the Post has adjusted to the new political reality and they're doing a good job.
Well, Jefferson Morley, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. I'll have to have you on again, maybe in the future, to discuss maybe the ghost in more detail. That's a really important book in my opinion. But for now, could you let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work? And also, I'm just curious, what advice would you give to, say, a young person listening to this that wants to get into journalism and maybe covering hard-hitting topics?
Right. So first of all, thank you for that. So if you want to follow my work, go to thedeepstateblog.org. No, deepstateblog.org, not the deepstateblog.org. The website is called Deep States. It's not a Trumpian website. It's a website that monitors the world's intelligence agencies. And if you want to get into and start to understand this world, I would just search around the site. Maybe click on we have a tab called Agencies, and we have profiles of about 20 of the world's largest, most important intelligence agencies, written from a nonpartisan, well-informed perspective. What do these agencies do? What do they do well? What do they do badly? What crimes have they committed? What's their reputation? Who are their leaders? What's their budget? Very straightforward information, but you can begin to understand how this world functions. You can also keep up with my work at jfkfacts.org, which is a website about the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963. Much narrower focus, might not be your cup of tea, but a place that brings out new information around the assassination of President Kennedy. I would urge people, if you're interested in that, in the JFK story, I have a new ebook out called Morley versus CIA, My Unfinished JFK Investigation. It's a Kindle ebook, Morley v. CIA. It costs 99 cents. And it's the story of my lawsuit that I pursued with the CIA for certain JFK files. And that lawsuit lasted 16 years.
So, and Brett Kavanaugh was one of the main villains in the story.
And Brett Kavanaugh steps in and plays an unwelcome cameo at the very end. But the story is very revealing about how the government, how the CIA perpetuates secrecy and suspicion around the JFK assassination story. So that's available now for only 99 cents. I have two other books if you're interested in these subjects. So my books are The Ghost, a biography of CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton, and Our Man in Mexico, which is a biography of Winston Scott, the CIA's top man in Mexico in the 1960s. So those are the books that really take my readers inside the CIA. You see how top CIA officers work, how they think, how they see the world. It's not uncritical, but it's not unfair or a hatchet job or anything like that. I don't approve of what these people did, but I really want people to understand why they did what they did and make people, get inside their heads. So that's how you can kind of get to know get to know my work and how I see these things. For young people starting out, you know, I mentioned earlier, you know, you want to get high sources of high quality information and understand how secret intelligence agencies work. A place that was very formative for me and which I still go to all the time is the National Security Archive at George Washington University. It's a nonprofit. It's not associated with the government in any way, has never taken any government funding. And they have extensive records on all kinds of issues in US foreign policy over the last 50 years. And so this is where you go for the original sources, right? This is how you understand, you know, what were the people, what was the president reading when it came to 9/11? What was the president reading when it came to torture? What was the president, what were the senators reading when it came to Trump and Russia? A place like the National Security Archive, you can really begin to get in there and see the original sources and begin to understand how it really worked from the inside. That's not to say you shouldn't read your newspaper and all that, but if you want to get deeper, you want to find quality sources. Another place I rely on a lot is a website called MuckRock. And MuckRock is a site that helps you do Freedom of Information Act requests. State government, federal government, you know, and they do great work. They've uncovered, you know, you use these Freedom of Information Act to, you know, obtain a police video, to obtain a 9/11 call, to obtain a budget, a sexual harassment proceeding, all sorts of things like that. MuckRock helps you do it, and they automate. It's very clever and high tech. And amazingly useful. So that's a place you can learn how the Freedom of Information Act works and how you can find information on your own. So, you know, we have a tough time now in journalism because we don't have a good business model. The old business models have gone away, right? The big internet platforms kind of captured all of the profits that those small town newspapers used to get and the big city newspapers. So we've had this distribution of wealth away from newspapers and into the big tech platform. So we don't have a good business model for journalism right now, but it's a bad time for journalists, you know, like me. My standard of living has been declining for years, but it's a good time for journalism. I mean, you know, the tools that are available, the ability to reach a mass audience quickly, the ability to have things go viral, you know, it's a good time if you're out there really finding new stories. It can be done. The tools are available. So it's a tough job, you know. There's not a lot of economic security in it, but it's very rewarding and very interesting. So the best way to get going is to really learn the tools of the trade, how to read a government document, how to file a Freedom of Information Act request, how to talk to people and find new information, and then put that together in a way that snappy, compelling, you know, not too snarky, you know. I think it's important to always be thinking about that person who doesn't agree with you. How do you write this so that they can hear it? You know, that's a challenge, but that's always a challenge in journalism. So bad time for journalists, good time for journalism, you know. So if you're interested in it, go for it. It's a great profession and livelihood.
Has that been, you think, part of your success, that ability to talk to people you disagree with or write in a way where they can understand what you're saying without getting all riled up?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, not only is it civil, right? It's also easier on your life, you know, to not hate people. You know, my brother is pro-Trump. You know, my son is pro-Trump. I don't hate them. I try and talk to them. Hate's not a good alternative. And for me, it's not an alternative at all. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to hate my brother. I love my brother. You know, I'm not going to disown him because we disagree about Trump. You know, we're going to talk about it, and it won't be easy. But, you know, I'm not going to scream at him. I'm not going to disown him. I'm going to try and talk about things so that he can hear it, you know. And that happens, you know, takes time. Not all the conversations are easy, but it can be done. And I think now, we understand the importance of doing it. So, you know, yeah, the other side's full of hate and full of BS and conspiracy theories and all that. You know, we still got to engage and present the new facts and what's true in a, you know, proud, non-defensive, but also non-offensive way. We don't want to offend people. You know, we're very polarized. We got to figure out how to talk to each other.
I agree 110% with that. I want to thank you again, Jefferson Morley, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you very much. Send me a link.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jefferson Morley. I thought it was a rather enlightening little back and forth that covered a great deal of ground. We went many different places, but let me know what you thought about the conversation by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Nathan, Holland, Chase, Zach, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well then consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon at patreon.com/ParallaxViews. That's patreon.com/ParallaxViews. There's also a $5 tier and a $1 tier. You can throw in $1 a month and it really helps me out. Any support financially is very much appreciated. You, the listener, are what will keep this show going. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.